Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, February 10th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, North Coast's $15 million economic development effort faces funding crossroad. California Department of Fish and Wildlife's cannabis program reports thousands of environmental impacts and hundreds of enforcement actions. And Arcata named in BBC travel article about sustainable small towns. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Millions of dollars is flowing into the North Coast region to promote economic development, but the flow ends this fall. Daniel Mintz reports.
The North Coast region has gotten millions of dollars of state funding for an economic development planning effort that brings projects to a pre-development phase, but future funding is uncertain. Progress of Redwood Region Rise, the North Coast's piece of a statewide economic development initiative, was updated during a February 4th online presentation to the Community Economic Resilience Consortium. Part of the California Jobs First initiative, Redwood Region Rise has brought together 150 North Coast community organizations and more than 1,200 residents to coordinate planning of projects that support economic development. Leonie Four of the California Center for Rural Policy, CCRP, at Cal Poly Humboldt said, quote, "In a nutshell, we try to be the connective tissue that helps projects succeed." So far, $13.2 million in state funding and $2.5 million of philanthropic funding has provided planning assistance for dozens of projects in Humboldt, Mendocino, Del Norte, and Lake counties. Amanda Pecana Hickey, also of the CCRP, described the results-based accountability framework that is driving the effort.
We think about, you know, are the things we're doing working, right? Is our program working on its goals, but also is it contributing to the larger changes we want to see in our communities at the population level? And if you look at Regional Plan Part 1, you'll see a pretty heavy emphasis on the kinds of metrics that we are looking at, you know, at a larger level. In 10 years from now, will we see poverty rates decline? Will we see median household incomes go up? Will we see affordability come into check? I mean, these are really, really hard things to move the needle on. They are subject to forces far outside our control. But within what we are trying to do, of course, is this big question of collaboration, which our collaborative members bring forward all the time as being sort of the value add of this last 3 years that we've been on this ride.
Greg Foster, Executive Director of the Redwood Region Economic Development Commission and the meeting's host, noted some challenges.
I think that, you know, what we've seen in the past regional efforts is where's planning, but without much in the way of ability to get resources to the ground afterwards in project funding, not more planning funding, but the actual tangible projects. So is that also a discussion about trying to codify either, and it probably wouldn't be new money, although that'd be nice, but codifying the discussion around all funding sources at the state, whatever the agency it comes through, to really recognize the regional impact and encourage regional cooperation and planning to access those funds? Or is that just too radical of a change for Sacramento?
The structure of future funding is an open question, said Hickey. Redwood Region Rise is funded through September, and state funding beyond that isn't guaranteed. But projects can be funded in a variety of ways, as suggested here by Susan Seaman of North Edge, which is leading the effort.
I think we finally sort of have the vision getting fine-tuned to create that brain trust of folks who understand lending and how can we get projects that are fundable in front of people who know how to find funding to help people get that capacity. So that's kind of where I see our role being after this, without funding. And then with funding, then it's a whole other discussion. I have no idea what that looks like.
California Governor Gavin Newsom's term ends in January 2027, and while Foster alluded to political change, he suggested there could be progress. He said, quote, "The next governor will be, I think, the sixth or seventh governor of California since I've started in my career, and you know those winds do change, but each time I think we move forward a little bit." For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
In a press release sent yesterday, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, CDFW, reported that their cannabis program awarded millions in grants, conducted hundreds of enforcement operations, and documented thousands of environmental impacts made by both licensed and illicit cannabis cultivation sites. The CDFW's cannabis program started in 2014, originally established as the Marijuana Enforcement Team. Back then, the program's primary focus was to combat illicit grows on public lands. In 2016, after the passage of Prop 64, which legalized recreational cannabis for adults 21 and up, the program expanded to include regulatory permitting, environmental monitoring, and remediation efforts. KMUD News spoke with Sarah Soule, Information Officer for Cannabis Topics at CDFW, for more information on what the cannabis program does.
Yeah, we have multiple different areas of focus. We do support for cultivators. They need to come through CDFW for some types of documentation in order to get a license to cultivate cannabis. So that's one of the things we do, is to support them when they might have a project that will alter a lake or stream bed, or if they need to let us know that they will not be altering a lake or stream bed. So we have that support for cultivators. We also do grants. We have a cannabis restoration grant program that makes use of cannabis tax funds to support projects and programs and partnerships that are good for the environment and California's natural resources. We also have an enforcement component to investigate and do enforcement operations at illicit cannabis cultivation sites across the state. And we do environmental monitoring and outreach and just a wide variety of things at the nexus of basically cannabis cultivation and impacts on California's environment.
Last year, the CDFW gave out millions of dollars through 20 grants for partnerships and projects that have the goal to improve the health of the California ecosystem affected by cannabis cultivation. These grants are funded through California's Environmental Restoration and Protection Account, which is a state fund designed to remediate the environmental damage caused by illegal cannabis cultivation and to support ecological restoration and wildlife protection. The account is funded partially by a 20% share of tax revenue from cannabis cultivation and sales, as established by Prop 64.
So projects that are eligible for these grants, they are not open to individuals. They are open to nonprofits, public agencies, and tribal governments. But they support a wide variety of work led by those groups. They're able to apply for funding year-round for projects that, you know, clean up illicit or abandoned grow sites, or maybe improve wildlife habitats in other ways, things that support sustainable cultivation practices, or you know, maybe training cleanup crews or advancing research related to cannabis and the environment. So just a wide variety of partnerships and projects that would help promote long-term ecological health in California and restore ecosystems, particularly in watersheds that have significant impacts from cannabis cultivation.
Both illicit grows and legal grows can have effects on surrounding environment, water usage being a big one, but other effects to the environment include light pollution, noise pollution, trash, and more. Soule elaborates more on the impacts illicit grows can have on public lands.
Illicit cannabis cultivation operations, if whether they're outdoor or indoor, and whether they're on private land or public land, can create significant threats to our natural resources and our public safety. The outdoor sites, they sometimes illegally divert water. They siphon it off from springs or dam, they put illegal dams in place to trap water and then use irrigation tubing to get it to their plants. They are illegally diverting water that's needed for fish and wildlife and for habitats, including sensitive species. They also contaminate soil and waterways with fertilizers, pesticides, fuel, soil that they've moved around, other waste products. They often clear native vegetation, just kind of cut it down in order to make room for grow sites, and that is problematic as well. They sometimes introduce non-native species, invasive species at these sites. They can create problems with like light pollution, noise pollution, and other things that directly impact fish and wildlife. And so that is partly why we are out there trying to dismantle these illegal grow sites and, taking enforcement actions to help protect watersheds and habitats for California's native species and the really unique biodiversity that we have here in this state. indoor grows that are illegal can also be problematic for the environment. They can involve unregistered pesticides, for example, and sometimes they might have like unsafe electrical issues and other types of public safety hazards. So there's these pretty broad environmental impacts and threats we see. And then, of course, these are also public safety concerns. Illicit cannabis grows that are taking place like this outside the regulatory framework are potentially bringing untested products to the marketplace that could have all kinds of problems. They could have problems with mold or pesticide contamination or who knows what. So that's one of the reasons we really recommend people, if they're going to consume cannabis, that they go to a licensed retailer for that.
Last year, the CDFW made 344 compliance site visits, conducted more than 200 inspections, led the service on 569 search warrants, and seized 129,096 pounds of processed cannabis, 878,478 cannabis plants, and 159 firearms. CDFW environmental specialists with the cannabis program enforcement and compliance work documented 2,150 environmental impacts. Environmental impacts include anything from water being diverted, illegal dams, illegal use of pesticides, and anything that would qualify as a violation of California Fish and Game Code.
Our environmental scientists documented more than 2,000 environmental impacts across 27 counties in California in 2025 that were related to either licensed or illicit cannabis cultivation sites. And these are things that might be in violation of Fish and Game Code or other types of problems that are causing environmental damage and affecting California's natural resources. Just in the short time I have been with CDFW, I have seen photos of thousands of pounds of trash and infrastructure at these sites, camping supplies, above ground pools that are full of water and fertilizer and unknown chemicals. I've seen toxic banned pesticides at these sites, water diversions, like I mentioned, and direct impacts on vulnerable species like Western Joshua tree or foothill yellow-legged frog or our Chinook salmon. And I've seen photos, at least, of poached animals at these sites. So when I'm looking at the number of environmental impacts that our scientists have documented at these sites, and I'm aware of what they individually are, it's hard not to think of the broader impact.
CDFW garners a lot of information from the public about illicit grows. Sol explains further how the public can help the CDFW and what to look out for.
Well, I would like everybody to know that the public is one of our best sources of information on illegal cannabis cultivation. When people are out hiking or hunting or fishing, they might come across something and they're uncertain whether it's safe to proceed. They don't know if maybe something's happening here. It looks like it could be an illegal grow site. Some of the ways to spot that would be if you're seeing irrigation materials, maybe black hosing or drip lines in an area where you would not expect to see those. You might see things like dams or water holes. Sometimes they're lined with tarps or black plastic to trap water and divert it elsewhere. You might see things like trash in unusual places, food wrappers, toothbrushes, you know, fertilizer bags, pesticide containers, or unusual trail markers that might indicate a path, evidence of any kind of gardening activity, garden tools, digging, terracing of soil, just things that you would not expect to see out on public lands, cut brush, you know, things that just would indicate some kind of operation is happening here. And if you do spot something like that while you're out hiking, the best thing to do is go back the way you came. If you encounter somebody near one of these sites, stay calm, don't be confrontational with them. I would not touch anything associated with the site. And then we would love it if people could provide tips to us. The CalTIP number is 888-334-2258. And you can also text an anonymous tip to 847-411 or report it via the CalTIP app. And that will let us know that there might be an illicit cannabis cultivation site out on public lands that we need to take a look at.
For more information on the CDFW and the cannabis program, the website is wildlife.ca.gov/conservation/cannabis. In a BBC travel article, Arcata was named as one of America's 10 most sustainable small towns. KMOD's Gabriel Zucker spoke with the journalist Natalie Zimmerman about her list and her thoughts on Arcata.
Last month, a BBC travel article came out about 10 of America's most sustainable small towns, and Arcata of Humboldt, California was named on this list. KMOD talked with the writer of this article, Natalie Zimmerman, a screenwriter and freelance travel journalist. She explained the thought behind the article and went over some of the criteria used in regards to Arcata.
I chose the towns for the community aspect and for the sense of place. I mean, we often hear about what big cities are doing for sustainability, and I wanted to focus on small towns. So for the criteria, it had to be a small town, not a big city, and it had to be a destination that people would want to travel to. Is it walkable? Does it have a quaint town and a place, you know, to explore in nature, like beaches and hiking trails or mountain adventures? There are a lot of towns that came up in my research that were sustainable, but I wanted the locations to be those that would make a good stop on a road trip or on a weekend away. And I also tried as best as I could to highlight different types of locations. So ones that had like a wide range of terrain and were in different locations in the country.
What stood out to Zimmerman about Arcata was the Arcata Marsh and how Arcata was a pioneer of sustainability before it became trendy.
The Arcata Marsh and Wildlife Sanctuary was a big draw for the sustainability aspect of the story. I mean, especially since it was established in 1981. It wasn't until the late 80s and 90s when sustainability started to become more mainstream in corporations and in the news. So the marsh was really at the forefront of that movement. And I feel like the towns that were pioneers in sustainability were important to showcase, and Arcata was one of them. When visiting the area, I mean, you can't help but be awestruck by the great redwoods. I mean, the forest feels like magic. I love just being in the quietness of nature, and there's like a real sense of peace and calm there.
To read the article, the website is bbc.com. This is Gabriel Zucker with KMUD News.
In state news, Congressman Jared Huffman speaks with KPFA's Lauren Schmidt about a potential government shutdown over ICE reforms.
It'll be a partial government shutdown, but it certainly involves the Department of Homeland Security, which is where ICE is housed. And what it boils down to is that Democrats have determined that giving more blank checks to ICE, who already has a budget bigger than the military budget of most European countries and is completely off the rails and lawless and acting like a bunch of secret police thugs in American cities, that we can't do that without major reforms. And Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer have put together a list of, I believe, 10 very meaningful reforms, ending the masking, ending these administrative warrants that ICE uses to barge into people's homes. There's a whole list of things that need to be done, and truly independent investigations when use of force occurs, body cams and so forth. And it looks like the administration and our Republican colleagues are unwilling to do these things. So we're not going to give. I don't think you'll see many Democrats agreeing to continue to fund ICE without these things, and I don't think Republicans are necessarily going to agree to them. So it does seem like we're on a collision course.
Are your colleagues divided on all of these proposals or just some of them? And is that opposition limited to Republicans, given that we saw 7 Democrats vote last month to approve ICE funding?
You know, I can't guarantee that there wouldn't be a few Democrats that crossed over and voted to fund ICE even without meaningful reforms. But I can tell you the overwhelming sentiment of my House Democratic caucus is no way. And that is a passionately held position. So we'll see where this goes. I suspect that there will be a partial shutdown for at least some period of time. I think we have the high ground here. And I think the American people are completely with us because they've seen with their own eyes what's going on. American citizens murdered by these secret police thugs and the brutal tactics that are rolling out, not just in Minneapolis, but in many other cities, and probably coming to a city near you if we don't enact these guardrails.
The current funding is set to expire going into the government shutdown, but I guess I'm not clear on how this will actually impact ICE funding due to the big, beautiful bill.
Honestly, it's a good question, Lauren. Because of what Republicans did in their big, ugly bill, ICE has a lot of directed funding that will not be affected. And so when you hear about a partial government shutdown, unfortunately, that could involve, you know, lots of different functions of the Department of Homeland Security, but the one that we actually want to rein in and change, will probably continue to get all the funding it needs.
How do you see this playing out, and is there a path forward?
Well, the path forward, as I see it, is for Republicans to make some concessions, to start treating Democrats as if we are relevant. I mean, they have just steamrolled Democrats at every turn in this Congress, and the administration doesn't like to talk about Democrats or engage with us, you know, except to vilify us. He actually stood up at the National Prayer Breakfast last week, of all places, and said that people of faith can't even be Democrats because we're just so awful. And, you know, it's one thing after another with him like that. He doesn't want Republicans to work with Democrats, and that has to change if we're going to get out of this.
And finally, Congressman Huffman, as Donald Trump seeks to nationalize elections, we're already hearing from constitutional lawyers who warn that the rule of law is effectively dead, citing concerns that the president now has a private police force, drawing parallels to authoritarian regimes like Hitler's SS, who enforced racial purity.
Yeah, this is right out of the playbook of any major dictator. It should be chilling to any American who knows anything about history, including recent history with Orban and other dictatorships. So look, this week we are going to have another Republican bill on the House floor called the Save America Act, which is like their previous version, the SAVE Act, but on steroids now, where you've sort of got to prove your citizenship, not only to register to vote, but to actually vote every single time, jumping through all these different hoops. And every state has to provide all its voter data to, you know, Kristi Noem and to Pam Bondi and anyone else in the Trump administration that wants to comb through it and use it. So it's a huge departure from the way we've always handled elections. It is very much in line with Trump trying to nationalize elections. And this is a big, big deal. This is something we need to draw a line on and fight about. And thankfully, I think there's very little chance of this going anywhere in the Senate, but we're certainly going to fight like hell this week here in the House. And I hope, given the narrow margins of the Republican majority, we might have a chance of stopping it.
In national news, Democratic lawmakers demand ICE reforms. Republican leader says Dems putting safety at risk. KPFA's Max Pringle reports.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York told CNN that ICE has been operating like an unaccountable rogue agency in places like Minnesota, and it's time that it was held to account.
We know that ICE is completely and totally out of control. They've gone way too far, and the American people want them reined in. Because immigration enforcement should be fair, it should be just, and it should be humane. So dramatic changes are necessary.
House Speaker Mike Johnson from Louisiana told reporters that Homeland Security covers a lot of important government agencies beyond just ICE, and that the Democrats are putting that funding at risk.
It's the Coast Guard. It's Secret Service. It's FEMA. We're in the middle of winter storms that people are still digging out from. So this is no time to play games with that funding. We hope that they will operate in good faith over the next 10 days as we negotiate this. The president, again, has reached out.
Democrats have recommended a raft of reforms to immigration and customs enforcement, policies that, they argue, would help keep the public safe and regain its trust. California Democrat Pete Aguilar is chair of the House Democratic Caucus.
Body cameras must be required by law, and masks must come off. Judicial warrants are a requirement, not a suggestion.
Democrats have also demanded that Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem be removed or resigned from her post. Republicans have called most of those demands non-starters as negotiations between congressional Democrats, the Trump administration, and its Republican allies in Congress appear to have stalled. Democrats have suggested splitting off other parts of the government from immigration enforcement and keeping those funded while the two sides continue to negotiate. Republicans have rejected that idea as not feasible. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
In national native news, Brian Bold reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders from across the country are gathered in Washington, D.C. this week for the National Congress of American Indians 2026 Winter Session and State of Indian Nations Address. NCI Youth Commission co-presidents Jonas Canusa and Angelina Serna kicked off Monday morning's assembly by delivering the Youth Commission speech. Serna says her message to tribal leaders is to recognize the contributions being made by Native youth.
I really talk about tokenism when it comes to Native youth and really putting youth at the forefront and having youth at these tables, at these conversations, and giving youth that opportunity to really learn, but also for the adults to be learners and teachers as well, and incorporating language and culture in everything that we do because what we do has spirit and has a purpose.
Canusa says his message to attendees is to help find ways for Native youth to get more opportunities, especially for those who live in remote areas.
Opening roles for more Native youth. I think Native youth in rural reservations have a hard time maybe connecting to maybe internships, fellowships, maybe just early on new jobs, entry jobs, because of those location barriers.
The Youth Commission co-presidents also touched on safety concerns when it comes to Native people and recent federal immigration actions across the U.S. They also talked about the commission's work this week on Capitol Hill to advocate for funding, harm reduction, treatment, and recovery models for substance abuse. NCI President Mark Macaro, who delivered the State of Indian Nations speech, followed the Youth Commission's remarks by saying young Native people are an important part of the NCAI.
In my time here at NCAI, the youth started to say, you know, we have a voice. You know, what we have to say matters, and it matters in this moment. And, you know, we took stock of that and been making strides to have them be more inclusive. They're right. And their take on the world, their take on issues in Indian country is different than ours. We need to allow ourselves to hear that, but we also need to create those opportunities for us to mentor them.
NCEI's winter session continues Tuesday with updates from federal agencies, including the Departments of Justice, Transportation, and Housing. Leaders will also hear from some members of Congress from New Mexico and Washington State. The history and effects of Indian boarding schools will be investigated and documented under legislation reintroduced by Oklahoma Republican Congressman Tom Cole and Kansas Democratic Representative Cherise Davids. Cole is a member of the Chickasaw Nation, while Davids is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation of Wisconsin. She's one of the first two Native women elected to Congress and has long spoken of the boarding school era, including on C-SPAN in 2022.
The policies and assimilation practices of the United States had the sole purpose of culturally assimilating American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian children in residential boarding schools across the country. Children were coerced and compelled to attend boarding schools away from their home. Many children did not return to their families or their communities. Those that did return lost generations worth of cultural knowledge, stories, and traditions, and communities lost their language keepers, cultural practitioners, and future leaders.
House Resolution 7325 would establish a commission to investigate and report on the histories of more than 500 federally run boarding schools, which operated between 1819 through the 1970s. And on this day in 1763, the French-Indian War officially ended. The armies of France and England wrestled for territory in the Americas, with both sides swaying Native tribes to help their efforts. Some, including the Ojibwe and Winnebago, helped the French, while the Iroquois helped England. While the outcome was favorable for the British, the cost of the war compelled England to raise taxes on the 13 colonies, eventually spurring the American Revolution. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Gabriel Zucker, Lauren Schmidt, Max Pringle, and Brian Bull. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.